Good morning, one and all. This morning's learning is lovely to see you all. It's sponsored by Ronnie Beth Herskowitz in memory of Ronnie's mother, Chaya Leah Bat Reb Tzvi Aleha Shalom, and also by Joel and Hedek Goodrich in memory of Hedek's mother, Chava. Chava Bat Moshe Manas, Aleha Sham in the Shemot Havaliot. Our learning is in their memory. May their memory continue to be a blessing. We're on Daf Chaf Bet. After today, we have two more Daf to go, and the last one is kind of three quarters of a daf, so we are well on the way to wrapping up, which is going to be key to the spirit of what we cover today, because what we'll begin today is the last thing you imagine would be the last thing in this Masechta. It is the first thing you would imagine would be the first thing, because again, the Masechet is called Masechet Makot. And so far we have insinuated that Makot exist, and we've spoken about them as a kind of taken-for-granted punishment, but we have not given any description to what it looks like, how it was carried out. And actually, I noticed the Koren version introduces, it has a picture on the front of the whip to identify this is what the Masechta is about. And so compelling is this image that actually this is two Masechtas. Makot is quite short. It's Makot and Shavuot. And they've decided the image that will capture your attention is the image of a whip. And I don't think that is incidental. And Chazal were being intentionally careful in front-loading everything we've done before we get to what is going to be the most gripping and interesting. And when you're in high school, this is what the kid... I have a vision in my head. I remember of the rabbi standing a kid up in front of the class and basically demonstrating without actually hitting him, saying, this is where the whip would go, this is how they would stand. And it's kind of a gripping image. And it's quite easy, I think, for human beings to get captivated by violence, harm, punishment, drama, and we've spent the last 21 dapim trying to identify what the purpose of this is. This is not as an outlet for society to beat up on people they see to be delinquent. And the sheet that I handed out, that I forgot to take one for myself, I'll get in a minute. Well, thank you. We'll see in a moment, the four psukim on the front are the psukim that would be read out as the makot were being given, and we'll see that in the Mishnah at the end of today's daf. And the picture is the picture of the whip. I don't have much to add to that in particular, other than I thought it might be helpful to see what it looks like, because probably most of us imagine Indiana Jones when we're thinking about a whip. That is not what this looked like, and it become key for a couple of reasons, or helpful as an illustration for a couple of reasons. So today we will do Mishnah 6, 7, and 8 of this final Masechta, with only two more to go. Two more Mishnahs to go. So we're at the bottom of page Chaf Aleph Amud Bet, right at the bottom. We had just started Mishnah 5 last time, which was one of the more famous Mishnayot in Makot, because it describes a case where a person is plowing his field and in one act is guilty of 8 separate crimes. And the crimes that we included last time at the top of Chaf Aleph Amud Bet in that Mishnah were plowing with kilayim. You've got a shor and a chamor. That's number one. Two and three, where they're both sacred animals. How can an animal be sacred? What are ways? You can designate it as a korban. What we're going to see on the basis of today's daf, that can't be what it's talking about. It must be talking about a case of bechor, which is it's born as a firstborn animal, which means it is by nature sacred. The central difference being, if I designate a korban, I can, in theory, redeem it and then use something else instead. But Bechor, it's kind of innate, its sanctity, and that can't be changed. So you've got, that's three. So you've got Kilayim that you're plowing with. They're both sacred. That's two and three. We've got Kilei HaKerem, that you are somehow facilitating Kilayim. How would you do that? Surely you have to sow seeds in order to do Kilayim HaKerem. That was a question the Gemara asked. And the Gemara answered by saying, oh, it's interesting. I would have just assumed this was Rabbi Akiva's view, that you don't need to sow seeds to do kilayim. You just need to maintain the field. But it turns out there was an extraordinary observation made by Rabbi Yochanan, who says maybe there are seeds lying along the ground. And as you pull the plow, it's tilling the soil and it's covering the seeds. And that is a version of sowing, which counts as well. So that was basically the whole green we did last week. So we've got four so far. Kilayim that you're pulling with the animals. They're both mukdashim. Kilei HaKerem's happening. It's shviya, so you're not meant to be working the land. It's shmita. That's five. It's yom tov, and you can't do plowing on yom tov. Harisha is a problem.
Cohen and a Nazir, and you're a Cohen and you're a Nazir, and you're in a cemetery. Neither of whom should be in a cemetery. Why can't a Cohen be in a cemetery? Because he's Cohen, because he can't become Tuma Lemate. Why can't a Nazir be in a cemetery? Because he's a Nazir, because there are three conditions that you accept as a Nazir. No wine, no haircuts, no Tuma Lemate. And the reason I stress that, even though it is obvious, is because there is a special category of Nazir where there are limited obligations. Anyone know which Nazir I'm referring to? So Nazir Shimshon is a special branch of Nazirut where, what are you not allowed to do? Can't cut your hair. How do we know that Shimshon didn't cut his hair? Because he's Shimshon. Because we know the story where he got in trouble for having his hair cut. He doesn't drink wine. How do we know Shimshon didn't drink wine? So that's less obvious. But there is an insinuation where he's walking with his parents, and then it says in the middle he had this massive fight with a lion, and then he went back to his parents, and his parents seemed not to be aware of the fact that he just fought a lion. And nobody knows exactly what happened. And the Radak suggests maybe he was being respectful for his parents, and he kind of went a separate way so as not to disturb them. And the Marbim says, well, actually, maybe they were walking through a Kilea Kerem, walking through a Kerem, a vineyard, and as a Nazir, he didn't want to walk through, so he kind of went around. So that's kind of an insinuation, and he bases it on a Chazal. So we know that he doesn't drink wine or even walk through a vineyard. We know he doesn't cut his hair. Does Shimshon avoid contact with the dead?
No,
he seems to seek that out, kind of. He does a lot of making people dead, Shimshon. So Nazir Shimshon is a branch of Nazirut where you can become Tamei Lemate, and that'll also become key in today's daf when we try and identify. We essentially unleash our imaginations. Now that you've said you can do one thing and get eight crimes in one go, the Gemara says, whoa, 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 only eight? Let's pile these on. And that's where we're up to last time. In the bottom of Chaf Al Amabet, we said, Amalei Ula, this is in the orange part, or red. Lilkin Amim Shimzarebi Yomtov. Hold on a minute, you can't plow on Yomtov, that's true. You also can't sew on Yomtov. And how do I know that you are definitely sewing for the author of this Mishnah? Because said, you're doing Kilayim. So you're admitting that you're doing Zoreya, because how else can you do Kilayim? So you're being Zoreya on Yom Tov. That should be nine. And this is where the Gemara said, hold on a minute. On Shabbos, each Malacha is a separate prohibition, and you would be punished independently. On Yom Tov, there's just a prohibition to do Malacha. And it's true, there are different Malachot, and that's how we identify that you've breached this law. But there's only one blanket prohibition on Yom Tov. So you can cook. But you can plow, you can sow, you can hunt, you can hunt. All sorts of things you can do on Yom Tov that are different breaches, but it's one prohibition. Thank you, John. And there's no problem. How do we know what?
That Yom Tov and Shabbos are, Shabbos has different prohibitions, but Yom Tov is just one.
So this is called Chiluk Malachas. It's the last narrow line. It doesn't exist. If you want to know more, we'll have to do Shabbos, Masechet Shabbos. But it's based on various psukim in terms of lo taseh melacha and how many times it's repeated in Shabbos and not repeated on Yom Tov in the context where we identify Yom Tov. And there's also a radical difference in the prohibition. What happens if you break do melacha on Shabbos? Chayv Misa. What happens if you break melacha on Yom Tov? Malchus. It's in the Mishnah. So there are various differences that we tend not to kind of teach when we're educating our children. We're less focused on what might happen to them than what we try to avoid. So that's the principle. So there's no chiluk malachas on Yom Tov, so that's why you only get Harisha on Yom Tov. Amalei Adar Tehei, and we said, and that's the reason, full stop. Now we're going to have a small section when we say, is that true that we don't have chiluk malachas on Yom Tov? As John says, how do we know that? I seem to have a source text that indicates we do. Eitve, Abaya. Abaya says, hold on a minute. Ein chiluk malachas b'yom tov? Thank you, question mark. Is that true that we don't divide it up? But none. We have a Mishnah where somebody also got very excited about how you can do one thing and get five punishments. Hatnan, it was taught. Amavashel gid b'chalav b'yom tov v'achlo. If you cooked a gid hanasha, that sciatic, is it sciatic nerve? That's what we always call it. If you cook the sciatic, say again. Oh, sciatic sinew. If you cook the sciatic sinew in milk on Yom Tov, va'achlo, and eat it, loka chamesh, you get five malchus, in theory. Loka mishum ochel gid. Number one, there's a prohibition to eat gid hanasha. Is gid hanasha very tasty, the sinew?
No.
Is it even classed as food? No, and this is very interesting, where there's essentially one prohibition in the Torah to eat something that is not food. And the fact that it's not food is key, because there's a debate about whether it can impart taste. If you cook gedanasha in something else, does the imparted taste make a difference? So we say, well, the taste, it's not food. So the taste doesn't actually have a property. It's just a sinew. Anyone ever chewed on a sinew? No? I mean, when you're having a chicken bone, sometimes you might put something in and you're like, this is very chewy. Sometimes it's cartilage. I mean, I don't want to get too graphic. Probably they don't have sinews on chicken legs, do they? I mean, I guess they do. How else do they walk? Yeah. Anyway, I'm obviously not a butcher. So eating gedanasha is one prohibition. Number two, cooking on Yom Tov, shelo letzorech. Cooking on Yom Tov without the need is a prohibition. Is that a prohibition, by the way, on Yom Tov, to cook for no need?
It has to be designated actual no need.
Right, you'd have to go out your way as we pass again. The author of this Mishnah took the view that actually it's very limited, the opening on Yom Tov. You can only cook if you've got a need for food. We have the view in kind of contemporary Psalk that anything that in theory could be used for food, you're permitted to do for permitted use. But he's got very limited reading. Gid is termed as meat. It's true that it's not food, but because the Torah says it's prohibited to eat, it's classed as food, and it's meat because it's from an animal, or it's part of an animal, I should say. So you're doing cooking basar b'chalav, and this is important. How many yisurim with basar b'chalav? Generally, what's prohibited with meat and milk? You can't eat it. You can't benefit, and you can't cook it. So even if you're cooking meat and milk, and you say, I just run a restaurant, I don't eat any of it, and I don't sell to Jews, I'm only cooking the meat and milk, that's a biblical prohibition to cook them together. This is, mentioned at one point, Rav Soloveitchik's grandmother, the legend says, used to have a separate garbage can for meat and milk in case she threw out some hot meat at some point and it landed on milk and cooked it in the bin, because that would be a prohibition of cooking them together. Seems it's a legend. Either way, it stresses the point that there's a prohibition to cook them together, even if you're not going to eat them. So far we've got three prohibitions if you cook gid b'chalav on Yom Tov. Number one, and you eat it. Number one, you're eating it in Asha. Number two, you're cooking a Yom Tov without need. Number three, you're cooking meat and milk together. Veloka mishum ochel basa b'chalav. Number four, you're eating basa b'chalav. And number five, mishum havara. Onto chaf bet amud aleph. So number five is you are cooking on Yom Tov. Or havara on Yom Tov. You're kindling on Yom Tov. So what have we identified as the five? Eating it in Asha, cooking meat and milk, eating milk and milk, making a fire on Yom Tov and cooking on Yom Tov. Sounds like how many Yisurim are related to breaking Yom Tov?
At least two.
Well, two, particularly related to Yom Tov, cooking and kindling a fire. And we've just said, in chaluk malachas b'Yom Tov, there's only one malacha prohibition on Yom Tov, whatever you do. So how can you classify them twice? Vim eaten, if you're right, mishum avari lo mechayv, you shouldn't be chayv for this kindling on Yom Tov. Chayv lo mishum b'shulo, because you've already been chayv on Yom Tov for bishul, so it seems like there is chaluk malachas on Yom Tov. So the Gemara says, epic avara, fine, remove avara from the list. Va'al gedanasha shel nevela, and add instead that it was a gedanasha of a nevela. Now, a nevela is a kosher animal that died or was killed without shechita. He's prohibited to eat that. So the gedanasha is considered nevela too. That would work quite well. Apart from the fact that Reb Chiya said in that list, that two of them are for eating, and three of them are for the way you're cooking it. And so far, I mean, Itan, if you're right that you should remove Havara and put in eating Gidanash of Nevela, that would switch the balance. Vimita Shalosh Lechilato Machayv, you now chayv for three eating. One is going to be you're eating the Gid, you're eating meat and milk, and you're eating Nevela. That's three for eating, and the two would be cooking on Yom Tov and cooking meat and milk. So you've now, that doesn't work for B'chia. Okay, Ela Apik Havara, fine. Instead of that, remove Havara, file Atse Asher, and say you were cooking with idolatrous wood chips. So now that's part of the cooking. So you're only chayv for eating meat and milk and eating gid. And the other three are related to cooking. Very nice.
Why was that so bad?
That was only bad because we had a tradition that said that shalosh al bishulo, three of them, so it has to be internally consistent, universally. We could just say, fine, that's Reb Chiya, ignore Reb Chiya. But the Gemara seems to say that Reb Chiya has an authority to say this Mishnah that listed five, three of them were about cooking.
What does it say three of them were about cooking?
Oh, sorry. So this is Chafet Amabet on the third line at the end. V'atni, it was taught Reb Chiya lo keshtayim lechilato v'shalosh v'shulo. He said the order of the Mishnah balance is, this is the third line, And we said, okay, so we can't switch the power. Three of them have to be to do with cooking. So we said, okay, so remove the cooking havara and put instead you're cooking with idolatrous wood chips. Okay. Vazhara mahacha, and how do I know you can't do that? It says you can't cleave to any of this idolatrous material, etc. Amalei Rav Acha b'rei d'Rav l'Rav Ashi. So Rav Acha responded to him and say, hold on a minute. If you add cooking with wood chips, you're now going to elevate it from five prohibitions to six. Because cooking with idolatrous wood chips is having them, using them, getting hana out of them. But in addition, there's also a prohibition just to have them in your house. So in theory, you would be sick, so you can't replace it with that. Okay, finally, end of this discussion. How do we resolve this Mishnah? Kagon shebishlo ba'atzei hekdesh. You were cooking with atzei hekdesh, and there's no prohibition on having hekdesh in your home. So you now got cooking with hekdesh, cooking gid in meat and milk, cooking on Yom Tov. Those are the prohibitions to do with cooking, eating meat and milk, eating gid. So those are the five prohibitions, full stop. Tosfot on the top left does ask a question. Say, hold on a minute. Is the only prohibition with hekdesh to get hana out of it or to use it? What other prohibitions would be involved in me burning hekdesh wood? Me'ila, I'm stealing from, there's theft involved. So there should be another prohibition. And he just points out in the last line of that first Tosfot, this is talking about b'pachot m'shava prota. It's not worth that much. So it wouldn't classify as official theft, but it would still be the prohibition. Okay, full stop. Simon, Shnai by Shnaz. This is just a way, obviously incredibly memorable mnemonic that none of you will ever forget. This is the acronym of the various names of the figures who now say, you said there were eight, let's raise the game. So again, this is all elaborating on one guy plows in the field and he's going to get eight prohibitions because he's a Nazir and a Kohen and it's Yom Tov and they're Kelayim and they're Hekdesh and he's doing Kilei Kerem while he's doing it. Another Gemara is going to propose seven possible additional prohibitions, six of which are going to be accepted. And one of which is not, for reasons we'll have to describe. So let's go. Why don't you say that where was he doing this? Not only in a cemetery. Where was the cemetery? It was a Nachal Eitan, which is not the name of a place, but a description of a geography. Nachal Eitan is a ragged valley. Nachal Eitan, anyone familiar with which context that would have to be used? Nachal Eitan? Egla Arufa. So if you found somebody who'd been deceased, you don't know the circumstances, the town gets together and they have to perform the ritual with Egla Arufa. They break a calf's neck. The crowd of the city stand there and the Sanhedrin said, we didn't do this, our hands are clear. And they have to do it in a Nachal Eitan. And part of the laws of that ritual is you can never work that area again. It has to be a testament to our failure as a society. You can't use this for economic prosperity. So he has got a cemetery in a Nachal Eitan, and he's a Kohen, and he's another, and it's Yom Tov, and he's planting Kilei Kerem, and he's working a Nachal Eitan. Why not? Add that on. Correct, why not? And how do we know that that's prohibited? Okay, number two. Why don't you add, maybe somebody had written the name of Hashem on a piece of paper, and as he's dragging this plow, the plow is going over that piece of paper and eradicating the name of God. Why not? Correct, the Gemara says, why not? How do I know you can't do it? We're told that you have to eradicate the name of idolaters, of idols, and you can't do that to Hashem, so that would potentially be included. Now, a question beneath all of this is, so why wasn't it included in the Mishnah? And that Gemara never answers that. There's a possibility we mentioned on the previous page, oh, why don't you mention sowing on Yom Tov? And before we said Ein Chelek Melachos, we said, so he left one out. And the Gemara said, no, he couldn't have left anyone out. He specified eight particularly. He wouldn't have left something out. There's a reason that we didn't include sowing on Yom Tov, and that's how we got to Ein Chelek Melachos by Yom Tov. And now we're going to suggest seven, and no point does someone say, well, why are they not included then? It's just assumed, yeah, that it's reasonable that these were not included. And perhaps we could suggest reasonably that these are of a different kind of imaginative options, that he's got a name with a Hashem in the middle of a Nachal Eitan in a cemetery. These are obviously fantastical possibilities, and he's not including those in the Mishnah. That was all reasonable within human affairs, and these are just, legally speaking, yes, Let's pretend that that's a compelling argument. So, Mangivlav Rabo, let's get another one in. This is the first one on the line is Velechshav. Velechshav Nami, Hakot sets at Baharto. And yeah, I think it is reasonable. Says that, how about if you're a Metzora, it is prohibited to cut off the part of the skin that has the symptoms of Tzaraat. So you are now in the field with this Kilayim of animals. While you're trying to sow seeds, eradicating the name, and you've stuck your toe right near the plow, so it cuts off the Beharis as it's going. And you're a Metzora, while you're a Nazir and a Kohen. Right. Yes, indeed. So let's say you can add that too. Is that possible? Vasarta Behacha, and the warning would be, Hishama Benegat Saras. You have to preserve these symptoms. You can't remove them. And the Gemara just leaves it as, yeah, I guess so. Matgivla Abaya. Or the truth is, you could suggest another reading that the Gemara's silence is really a kind of indictment on, I'm not going to, you know, give this a response. Meaning, yeah, in theory, but we're trying to be real here. We're not having a game. We're trying to show that in one act, you can be criminally liable for multiple crimes for the harm you're doing to society. And the Gemara's saying, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And the Gemara's like... Right, and meaning, and the Gemara silence might be a way of insinuating that this isn't a game. We're talking seriously about how society can crater. We're not just trying to pile this on. So maybe you could see the Gemara's lack of response in that way as well, while also showing that creativity. Okay, first word on the line is Mehacha, right next where it says Sham Chavdal. Malik Vla Abaya, Abaya says last one within it, Abaya. Velech Shev Nami Hamaziach HaChoshen. Maybe while you're doing this at the same time, you pull off the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol while you're doing this. Yeah, how might you do that? Well, he's a Kohen Gadol, so he's outside the cemetery. But while he was napping, wearing his big begadim outside the Bet Midrash, you tied some string to his Choshemishpa, and then put it onto the plow. And now you pulled, and it came off. You woke him up. Everything's a disaster.
Oh, mitzvah.
Maybe as he was walking in the Bet Mikdash, there was a Beis Mitzvah, so he had to go with his begadim. Right, yeah, yeah. I mean, the gymnastics you have to do to make this work. There is a suggestion in Tosfot, if I'm not mistaken, that maybe he removed it from the Kohen Gadol yesterday, and he's carrying it around. As long as he's carrying it, he's still violating that prohibition. So maybe he's holding the Choshen, so that's much more believable now. He's holding the Choshen Mishpat while he's doing this, so why not add that on?
This was the inspiration for Rube Goldberg when he did all of this contract.
I don't know who that is, but I can figure out why. Right. So that's a possibility. How do I know you can't do the V'lo Yasur V'lo Yizach HaKoshen? You can't remove them. There's a prohibition on all of that. Margivla Ravashi. I guess another way you could see this is not just the Gemara silently responding, but this is, again, trying to depict the scope of Jewish ritual law. As we were saying, there are all sorts of prohibitions in Jewish law that involve no harm to anybody. And so far, the Mishnah has been quite limited in what it's articulated, which has been foods, entering the Bet Mikdash, acts of intimacy that are prohibited, eating Maaser Sheni, cutting your hair, removing tattoos. And we've said there is a logical progression getting more and more close to the self, eventually into the mind, where you can do multiple things at the same time. And maybe the Gemara is taking an opportunity to say, and don't think that this is it. You know, there are prohibitions on removing the Kohen Gadol's clothing. Nobody's being harmed there. There are prohibitions, I guess, on cutting off a symptom, which I guess you might be self-harming to some degree, but you're also trying to save yourself from having to go through process of Tzaraat. There's lots of ways in which we could, in theory, see this as trying to expand the scope of our legal imagination. Okay, Ravashi says, let's add another one. What about if you are plowing when the wood you're using to plow is made from an Asherah tree? You're not allowed to get benefit from Asherah tree. So we mentioned that before when we raised the possibility of cooking with Asherah chips. So we've now said, why not add that? That the plow is made of Asherah wood? Maybe. Full stop. Matgivla Ravina. Ravina adds, oh, Velech Shev Nami HaKot Tzilanos Feves. And maybe while you're doing this, while you're plowing, you're also, what is it called? Felling. Uprooting, cutting, felling trees that you're prohibited to cut. And this is a prohibition that is associated with Baal Tashchit, which is if you have fruit-bearing trees, it is prohibited to cut them down. This is, of course, still a contemporary issue. In theory, if you've got a tree in your backyard you want to remove or something, and it's a perfectly good fruit-bearing tree, in theory, there has to be a very good reason to remove it. You can't just take it down because, you know, it's my property, I'll do what I want, kind of thing.
Is that a worldwide prohibition, or it's just around prohibition?
That seems to be a worldwide prohibition. It's discussed in the context of war, which in theory could take place anyway. When you go to war against your enemy, it's talking about besieging their cities and not cutting down trees in the process. And it seems to be a very limited law about kind of ethics of warfare, but it's expanded by Chazal to essentially don't waste anything that has good purpose. Okay, two last skinny lines. Reb Zeira la Reb Mani. And this is going to be number seven. So far we've had six proposals. Number one was Nachal Eitan. Number two was Mechikat Hashem. Number three was cutting off the Baheres. Number four and five were the removing the Bade of the Aaron and the Chosh Mishpah, the Kohen Gadol. Number six and seven were using idolatrous trees or cutting down good trees. And now this is going to be number eight, which is rejected. How about you add, he took an oath, I will never ever plow on Yom Tov. Now he's doing that, so he's now violated his oath. That should be number nine in the Mishnah, or at this point, number 16. Hatam, the Gemara says, whoa. I've let you go wild here, and I haven't interrupted. I've let you give all these possibilities, but this doesn't work. Halakha chala shavua. That shavua doesn't work. Mushbavam nahar Sinai. You can't come along and say, I take an oath never to break any melachas on Shabbos. And then if you break it, you're chayav for breaking your oath. You're already bound by that. You can't take an oath on things that you've already essentially taken an oath to, and you're committed to keep those laws. The oath that you have to take has to be something that is not already binding upon you, is the assumption.
Why wouldn't they just stop? Just don't include the word Yom Tov, and then you have a...
Amalei, so he says to him, maybe as he turned around and he said, oh, I swear never, ever, ever to plow on any day, whether it's Yom Tov or during the week, says the Gemara. And you should say, since the oath was effective that I can't plow any day, it should also be effective on Yom Tov. And now the Gemara is going to find a way to say, no, it still doesn't work making an oath. So, option number one, why it doesn't work. Midi de ite b'she'ela lo katani. Something which you could remove, they're not talking about. And how could you remove this possible prohibition? Meaning, are you ever permitted to plow on Yom Tov? Are you ever permitted as a Kohen to be in a cemetery when it's not your Krovim? No. All those things are inexorable prohibitions. The oath... What could you do, in theory, to get rid of that prohibition? You are made for it. You go to a chacham and you say, I don't want to be bound by this anymore. So it's still in force, and you're right, it would be a prohibition, and in theory you would get nine makos, but the Gemara is not teaching cases where you could remove those prohibitions in theory. Velo, is that true? Vari hektash. It said that the animals were hektash, and surely you could remove that kedusha by redeeming them. And that's where we go, b'bechor. It must be talking about the case of b'bechor, where they're naturally sacred. So that's included in the Mishnah, because that prohibition is also eternal. Vari nazir. Hold on, nazir is there. You can remove nazirut. But nazir shimshon. I was talking about nazir shimshon. And nazir shimshon, the assumption is, you can never remove. If you accept on yourself to be nazir shimshon, you're stuck. And then the Gemara says, hold on a minute. Nazir Shimshon bein tumah lemetim hu? The whole problem with the Nazir is in a cemetery. And we've just said Nazir Shimshon, there's no problem with tumah. And they're like, oh yeah, good point. So what should we say? Ella, hi tana itzu kola lesli. This teacher must be of the view that if you take an oath, and part of what's covered by your oath is something that's already prohibited to you, the oath does not apply to that. So I say, I'm never ever going to plow ever again. And then I start plowing on Yom Tov. Have I violated my oath? According to this Tana, no, because you already prohibited, so the oath doesn't take effect on that activity. So that pushes back on that. Full stop. And while the Gemara is now reflecting on compounding crimes in one moment, this is a nice piece of trivia. How can you ever be over on Kilayim with plowing with an animal when it's only one animal? One animal, and you're over in Kilayim. This is going to be the case. Amar Reb Hoshe. Reb Hoshe says, Hamarbia, if you interbreed Shor Psulei Mukdashim with an ox that was made invalid for Hekdesh, Lokeshnaim. You get two malkas. So you had an ox, you designated it for the Bet Mikdash, and then it became possible for whatever reason, got a mum, and you transferred its Hekdesh, its sanctity, onto another animal, which then you're going to take to the Bet Mikdash. What happens to this possible ox now that you were going to take, but now you've redeemed? What can you do with it? What can't you do with it? Any rules, or just a regular ox?
Still Hekdesh.
So can you eat it?
Dive natural causes.
So there are cases of tamura where you have to leave it to dive natural causes. If you have redeemed it through the legal process because it came invalid, it is a hybrid where it has partial sanctity, which means you're not allowed to share it. I don't know who shares oxes, but you're not allowed to share it and you're not allowed to work it. But you are allowed to eat it. You can shecht it and eat it as a regular animal. It doesn't have to die and you can't shecht it. But you're not allowed to work it, and you're not allowed to share it. So it's got this, again, hybrid identity where it can't be worked, but it can be eaten. So it's kind of hekdesh and it's kind of not. So here the Gemara said, if you interbreed with that animal, you are now over on two lavim. Number one, you worked a potentially sacred animal. And number two, whichever animal you interbreeded this animal with, kilayim is going to be involved because it's half hekdesh, half not. So if you interbreed it with a hekdesh animal, you've done interbreeding between a hekdesh and a chol or a non-hekdesh animal. And if it's a non-hekdesh animal, you've done it with it. So, and what happens if I take another hybrid and I interbreed it with another hybrid?
Yeah, it should be okay, right?
You would think, but maybe each half is collided with the other half. So, right. So, again, what we're, I guess you could say homiletically here, is portraying a picture of a complex interior life, where an animal is identified as being kilayim on its own, as having two identities. And again, what we're trying to pave out here is that the human being's interior world is what we're concerned with when it comes to crime. We are going to hold you liable in one act for multiple crimes because we've warned you and you've had that in mind and you're doing it intentionally. And that's what this is all about, marshalling our powers as human beings to live together in harmony. And that means being internally aware, which is why we had a whole perek dedicated to what does it mean to be intentional, what does it mean to be accidental, and that's why we had a whole perek dedicated to scheming. When you have a scheme in your head but nothing happens, you get punished. And that's, again, we're laying the groundwork to get to this Mishnah we're about to read. Let's do this last line in the orange. Rabbi Yitzchak says, "Hamanig b'shor psulei mikdashim," if you start leading, meaning if you're doing in the field, with one animal who we describe, this ox that became pasul, you know, leading it through the field, loke, you get malkus. Shahaya guf echad, va'aso akad of shnei gufim. Because even though it's one animal, it's got two identities. So this is, again, like a good piece of trivia. How can you ever be over on plowing kilayim with one animal? Now, in truth, if it's psulei mikdashim, it's determined as both hektish and not. So if you're pulling with it, it's kilayim in your field. Astonishing possibility.
Rabbi,
yes.
Is it possible?
Yes.
Anything's possible. That the rationale for giving all this many lavim that the person is going over is that there will be more warnings to this person because of all the lavim that he'll be over. And maybe one of these warnings will resonate with the perpetrator. So he will say, "Oh, if I'm going to also be over that, let me not do it."
Interesting. And meaning, and we're doing all this to say.
I mean, because otherwise, what's, you know? I mean, unless it's just an academic exercise.
Right. Meaning, what are we getting out of this? I think
in law schools all the time. Students are given hypothetical cases which are totally impossible, but to get them to conceptualize the law. And the Supreme Court, when they have a hearing, they ask the lawyers, you know, crazy, what if, all to clarify what's behind it.
Yeah, and so I guess the question would be, so the question is, what are we clarifying? So in law school, they ask a question to get, if it's like a tax law, they're going to say, what about this deduction? What about that exemption? And they'll go through, what about if I'm doing something that is not medically necessary but medically approved, is that a deductible? And then, okay, so what are they clarifying? They're clarifying what is the principle of deduction. So the question, Ronnie, I guess, would say here is, well, what are they clarifying? It's not like we've honed in on any one of these things and gone through impossible variations to get to the heart of what does it mean to do Mechikat Hashem. We're being incredibly superficial with each one of these cases. So there must be something in common about all of them we're trying to clarify. And your question is, what is that? And it seems to be, at some level, that we're trying to show that what Marcus is about is what's in here. That's the claim we've been making, is that we're just accumulating as many crimes as possible to say it is not really about separate acts. This is one act where we're showing that in one act you can be violating tens and tens of crimes, because it's not about your behavior. It's about your mental state, which will contribute to the fall, again, of a civil society. And the point of this, again, is Malchus is not about beating you for bad behavior. It is about making you a productive citizen. And at the core of being a productive citizen is mastering your mind, saying, I will intentionally live well. I will consider my neighbors. I will actively go out of my way to do what's right. And even though this seems to be, you do something wrong, you get hit. We've spent the whole Masechta trying to show that, yes, that's true, but that's only because that's how we identify how you're going to be a productive member and citizen of society. And this is, again, showing, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? Yes, 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 yes. You could get it all, apart from a Shavua, because that wouldn't apply in our case, because you're already prohibited. So it's a good question, and I'm not sure that's a completely satisfying answer, but...
Are we able to identify the mnemonic to each of these things? Like, in one of them, I was trying to figure it out.
Somebody has.
Yeah.
I mean, I've highlighted in pink. I knew there'd be a use for this eventually. I put the names in pink. So right after the Simon, Reb Hoshia has got a Shin. Reb Hanania has got a Nun. Abai has got a Bet.
So it's
Ashi's got an Aleph. Ravin has got a Yud. It's just a letter from one of the names.
Oh, a letter.
Yeah. Again, it's very memorable. So let's do this mission at the bottom. Come a Malkin Oto. How many Malkas do you get? Finally, we're getting to the Malkas. How many do you get if you do something wrong? We haven't even said that yet. And so far, again, you're in law school and you're talking about Malkas for 25 pages. The first 21, you've got no idea how many you're getting, in theory. It's come up incidentally. But how many do you get? Arbim v'chaser achad. You get 39. Shnei mar, as it says, b'mispar arbayim. 40. Minyan shu samach la arbaim. It says b'mispar arbarim, which means within the number of 40. So what's within the number of 40? Yeah, 1 through 40. So we're saying, well, it says 40 and it says within it. That's actually a reasonable way to read. It must mean 39. Rabbi Yehuda omer arbarim shleimas uloka. Rabbi Yehuda says, I'm not interested in those games. 40 is what you get. Heichan uloka et hayetera. And now the Mishnah is taking for granted, again, a principle that they're assuming we're familiar with, which is the Malkus were divided into two-thirds and a third of where you were hit. And this is where my teacher would get a kid up and say, okay, how do you whip? So this long whip you'd have, we'll describe the whip in a minute, there would be lashes given on the chest and lashes given across the middle of the back. So we say, okay, so you've got a third on the front and two-thirds on the back. If you're having 40, you can't divide that into a third and two-thirds. 39 you can. What would it be? 39 divided... 13. Say again?
1326.
Thank you. 1326. Accountant. So 1326, what do you do with the extra one? Where does that go? On the front or the back? And if you heard answers, it goes bin k'tei fav, right here. And there's got to be a joint or something where the shoulder blades come together at the back, I think. No. Is there anything?
Spine.
All right. That sounds dangerous. The principle is meant to be in the middle of the back is less dangerous because it's a more...
There's bone there.
Bone.
There's bone there for a reason.
So. Right, okay. So the assumption Rabbi Yehuda will have, as we'll read it as we go forward, is that that extra one is ben k'tei fav. Fine, full stop. Ein om demoto elba makoro yilishtalesh, and the Mishnah says, again, taken for granted that we are not interested in killing anybody. These lashes are not, you did this crime, you get 39 lashes. You did this crime, you're going to get lashes. The maximum number is 39. But we are going to have a doctor take a sense of what you can take, because killing you is not the point. And again, this is the first mission of the Perek. We said Misa and Malkus are radically different things. None of the things listed in that first Mishnah would you get Misa and Malkus together, because they're radically different punishments. One is, you no longer are worthy as a citizen on earth, and the other is we're trying to make you a better citizen. So they're radically different. So we're going to do an estimation. And here, the only numbers you can have, the doctor has to give you, divisible by three. Because a third needs to be on the front and two-thirds on the back. So the doctor says you can take 21. What's the number you're going to get?
7 and 14.
7 and 14 would add to?
Yeah, 21.
So what if the doctor... did I say 21?
Yeah.
Okay. What if the doctor said 20? Which is what I meant to say. How many would you get?
8, 6, and 12.
You'd get 18. It would go down to the nearest number divisible by 3. Bottom line. Amdo lakabel arbaim veloka miksas. If the doctor said you can take 40, and then we started administering the lash, and we got to number 4, and we're thinking, this guy's not going to make it. He's not getting to 40 over the page. Amrushin yachol lakabel arbaim. We're like, I don't think he's going to make it to 40. Patur, stop. If you think he can't take anymore, stop. We are not going to say, this is the punishment and risk the possibility this person will die. You've got to stop. Amdu lakabel shmona esrei. If they did an estimation and said, this guy's a little bit weak, he can't really take more than 18. Umishalaka, and as you're hitting him, you're at 16. And the guy's like, yeah, another one. 17. He's like, and then I think he can take more than this. Maybe we should ramp up the punishment. Pater, still, no. We never heighten the number you're going to get once we've started, and we are willing to lower it once we've started. We start hitting you, think you're not going to last, we're not going to kill you. But if we said you only get 12, and then you woke up that morning, and the adrenaline is pumping through your veins, and you've like been building up all morning, and then they hit you, and it doesn't feel anything, we just got to stop. We're not in the business of trying to hurt you.
The Mishnah implying that there's a monitoring process, that there's somebody there who's watching and determining whether or not this person can handle it.
Yeah, and I don't know why that's bringing an image to my mind. I'm thinking of something where there are punishments or something where there's somebody there watching to make sure it's safe or okay.
Probably a movie that you watch.
Yes, I'm sure it is, and it's driving me insane because I'm trying to think of what
movie. Boxing Match has a doctor there.
That's usually the opposite. When someone has a match penalty, you have to, the doctor has to declare that the person.
So the doctor declares the person's dead, but I've got a vision of like a doctor standing by to say, okay, this is not going to kill them, this is not going to kill them. Yeah, it's probably some movie where they're doing experimentation on some superhero and say, he's fine, and then, oops, he's Spider-Man, sorry about that. I don't know. But yes, that's the assumption that somebody is monitoring. People are paying very close attention throughout this process, and by the time we get to the bottom line of this stuff, we're going to see that there is a way out to all of this. A way to avoid malchus entirely if you have been found guilty of a crime. Because again, it is not about administering punishment for the sake of, you know, civic catharsis. My Tama, the Gemara begins by saying, hold on a minute, let's go back to this number business. You said 39. How could you say that? Iktiv abam mispar. If it would have said 40 in number, hava amina arben b'minyana, I would agree it means 40 in number. But since it says within the number of 40, it means the number that heads right into 40. It is worth noting at this point, the pasuk does not say b'mispar arba'im. It says hakot b'mispar, full stop, arba'im yakenu. But this being read in conjunction to make this point. Amar Rava, and this is again a rather well-known four lines. Rava says, "Kamatip shai shar inche. How foolish can people be? The kamei makmei sefer Torah who stand up before sefer Torah, the kamei makmei gavar rabba, but don't stand up for a great person. Deal b'sefer Torah k'tiv arba'im. The Torah says 40. V'at rabbanim bat shulchada. And the rabbis Chazal come along and say it means 39. And the assumption here is the Torah is a sacred document. Chazal, who are empowered with its interpretation, are in here even more sanctity at some level, and you should of course be standing up." For somebody who embodies that kind of authority morally and culturally. Again, we could spend a lot of time talking about the power of Chazal, how halacha works and evolves and turns and can authoritatively perhaps shift over time, but we'll leave that for now. Rabbi Yehuda Omar Bar Shlemus. Rabbi Yehuda said you get 40 in their entirety. We said, where's the extra one put? The extra one is put between the shoulder. Amr Rabbi Yitzchak, my time, Rabbi Yitzchak says, how do I know
you get it between the shoulder? How do I know you get 40? What is Rabbi Yehuda's compelling argument? Meaning we've had a good reading of the pasuk that says it means 39. What's Rabbi Yehuda's case? He said we have to look to Zechariah, which describes a messianic moment where God projects to the prophet an image of a wounded person, and the angel says to this person, Maha makot ha'ila ben yadecha, what are these wounds or these lash marks that are between your arms? What's between your arms? Ben ktefav. It's like the description of that middle part. What are those wounds on your back between that? Your arms. Va'amar. And this figure will say, Ashehu kani beit mahavai, I was struck by the house of those who love me. Yes, it's a... Say again. Ben, what is ben yadecha? Between your hands, I guess it's in the middle. So the assumption is, I was struck by those who love me. Who loves me?
Based on.
Say again?
Based
on. Yeah, based in, presumably. And again, what is the assumption here? That we are not hitting you because we're vindictive. This is an act of social care. Again, it doesn't feel good, I imagine, to walk into court for your lashes and say, oh, we love you, that's why we're doing it. And I'm sure any of you who've ever either participated in one end or the other of corporal punishment in the context of education or child rearing, I'll put it lightly like that, and I'll say I've participated in it on the receiving end. The assumption is the person who is doling this out does love you. And at that moment, they're not like overwhelmed by a sense of this is an act of affection, but it's recognized I wouldn't do this to somebody who I care about in no way. I'm doing this because I want you and I expect you to live well. And that's because I care for you as a human being.
This hurts me more than it hurts you. That's like,
is that a movie?
This is going to hurt me more than it hurts you.
Right, is that from a movie?
A parent, no.
Oh, okay. Because then how would I know it? Right. Right, and that's the assumption here, that the Beis Din should be feeling the same way. You should not be thrilled. Oh, I wake up, why did I become the Shlech Beis Din to do this whipping? I just love whipping things. Anyone seen the movie Count of Monte Cristo? Yeah? There's a scene in Count of Monte Cristo where they send off to Chateau d'If, this kind of island prison. And of course, the person in charge of the prison is some sadistic sociopath who enjoys lashing these figures who have been put in jail without trial or due process. That is not what the Beis Din should be doing. This should be people who are, as you say, feel more hurt by this than they hope the person is hurt in doing it. And this is his proof, Rabbi Yehuda, that you must have 40 lashes. Why? Because there's somebody who says, I've been hit by Beis Din, and it's Ben Yadecha. So it can't be talking about the other kind of lashes. It must be. Now, what does it say? Mahamakot. What are these wounds in the plural? So how can Rabbi Yehuda use this to prove that there must be an extra one lash? That's the question some of the commentators ask, which is why this picture is helpful for some people, and say, well, even with one extra lash, you're going to get multiple wounds because there are multiple layers to the strap. That's one answer that seems a little pedantic for our purposes, but let's keep moving. Rabbanan, how do the rabbis resolve this verse? They can't deny that the prophet has a vision of a wounded figure saying to an angel, I was struck by those who love me right between my shoulders. Sounds like an exact proof from Yehuda's contention. Their answer, Ho betinokot shel beit Rabban hu dichtiv, that's talking about children. Not people in Beis Din, but children who say, why am I wounded? Because I've been struck by my teachers at school between the shoulders. And Rabbi Yehuda has to turn around and say, okay, I guess that's a reasonable reading. And again, what messianic vision are you perpetuating if you take these different views? If you've got somebody who's been struck by court systems, somebody who's been struck by teachers, again, there's a lot one could unpack, even in this supposedly legal reading that is quite agadic. Let's keep going. Etc. We said, hold on a minute. You, for Rabbi Yehuda, you have to make an assessment. If it is more than... if they say you can get 40 and then you clearly can't manage it, we stop. If we've started, is what it said in the Mishnah. And if you say you can take 18 and then they seem to take more, you said once you've started, you can't change it. So the Gemara is going to now respond. Laka in, lo laka lo. It sounds like only if you've started do you start asking the question of whether you shift the number. But it sounds like if you haven't started yet, so you've been assessed for
You can only take 12. And then you arrive that morning, and we say, look at this guy. This guy can take, he can take 850. Who said 12? So you've already made the estimation. You've got to stick at 12. Sounds like if you haven't started, you can up the ante, so to speak. So Uramino, and we have a brighter that seems to indicate that. Under the Kabbalah Arba'im, if they estimated you could take 40, and they said, no, you can't, pater. You say that you don't give him the full amount. We said, and if you estimated and said they can take 18, and then they reestablished and said you could do 40, but you still don't give 40. So this brighter makes it sound like even if you haven't started the process, you can reassess. Whereas our Mishnah made it sound like only if you've started. We're talking about different cases. One is when you've given a daily assessment, meaning two assessments in one day. If I go to my doctor's appointment on, I don't know what day it is, Sunday. If I go on tomorrow to my doctor's appointment, what's the first thing you do when you walk into your daily, your yearly checkup? You get on the scales. And they like, I say, should I take off my shoes? And they say, no. Like, what do you mean, no? I'm trying to take as much off as possible. So you get on the scales. So if I stood on the scales and I got a round number for my weight, and then at the end of the visit, said, you know what? I'm not sure whether the nurse did it or not. Just get on the scales. And I got on the scales, and it was like a 10-pound difference. And I'd just been sitting in this visit for 15 minutes. That would tell me what? Yeah, there's something wrong with this machine, or I've got an eating habit that I'm not aware of that is deeply troubling. So if it's on one day and you do an assessment and it's radically different, the assumption is the assessment's off. So there, if you haven't started, we're willing to make changes at that point. You've been assessed for 40 and then you come and say you can only take 18. Say, so only give 18 because that first reading was obviously way off. But if you give an assessment and then you wait another few weeks and you wait another few weeks, you're not saying the assessment's bad. You're saying, so we'll wait till you, and then the assumption is, so what happens? If I gave you an assessment, you can take 40. 2 weeks later, we have an assessment, so you can take 12. What do you do at this point? It sounds like if you haven't started, you've said you can't make a change. You still have to get 40. But now you've got a doctor saying you can only take 12 at this point, but that assessment was right. So what do you do? The assumption is, the Rishonim assume, because it's not discussed here, is that so you're just going to have to wait until you get better and you can take 40. Or we start going, I guess, and then we have to adjust if we see that you can't. But it may also be a way to kind of weave out of this punishment. It's just looming over you that we're not going to start until we get a confirmation from a doctor that you can take 40, because that was the assumption you got. I mean, I don't know how many of you saw images of Harvey Weinstein like 3 months after he was indicted for the first time, where he was indicted and he was like an active director or producer, whatever it was. 3 months later, this image of a man hobbling into court, like he'd aged 40 years or something. And I assume when you're under indictment in all sorts of ways, it can impact your health. And the assumption is if you were assessed, you could take 40. And then 3 months later, you've become a shadow of who you were. We don't implement this punishment until you recover. And there are consequences to not having implemented it. If you haven't had malchus and you have been given a verdict that you deserve them, what can't you do? So there are limits. You can't be a witness. You are considered a rasha, meaning you're considered a guilty felon until you've had this applied of malchus. So that you're going to live with the fact that you can't fully re-enter society yet until you've had this punishment, but we're not willing to give it until you've recovered. Why might that be? I mean, in theory, you could say, so just adjust the assessment and give him what he is right now. And it seems like we're trying to punish the person who did this act, not the diminished figure now, kind of living in a shadow of that. But we can leave that for another time. Mishnah, next Mishnah. Avar aveva sheyesh ba shnei lavin. If you did an aveira which has two prohibitions involved, amdu omed echad. You only make one assessment. So you did that thing with the plow in the cemetery on the ragged valley. We say, okay, so you've done nine prohibitions. How do I assess? We've said you should amdu omed echad, loke apata. Do one assessment. So let's say we've determined you can take 100 lashes. So you did 8. How many should you be liable for if you do 8 times 39? John, you're 8 times 39? Too much?
312. All right, there you go. So we said you can take 100, but you're liable for 312. So he said you just give the 100. V'im lav, but if you don't do one assessment, meaning, so let's say you did 8 assessments on how many, on different days, how many you can take. Loka mitrapa v'chose v'loka. So if you've done 8 different assessments and we say you can take 50, so you get 39, then you got to wait. 39, you got to wait. 39, you got to wait. So it's in your interest to get one assessment and go with that. But Tanya, but it taught in a brighter. Hold on a minute. We said you don't do more than one assessment for more than one prohibition. You have to split it up and get it separately. If the single assessment came back, you can only cope with 41. You're right. That does not count as one assessment because you need to have at least 3 for each lav. So what should you do? If you are liable for these 8 prohibitions, you should get one assessment. If that one assessment comes back and says you can only get 41, you don't just get 41 and that's it. You get 39 for the first prohibition and then you get assessed again for the next. But if it comes back and you said you can get 42, say that's all you need because we've now assessed and you need at least 3 extra for the third, for the second one. Again, if you needed 8, in theory, I guess you need to have, what was it, 312? So you're going to be... Now do 7 times 39 and add 2. 7 times 39?
280 minus 7, 273.
270. So let's say you get assessed for 274 and you've done 8 crimes. We say you can get for the first 7, but we can't count the 8th one in that last bit because it's only 2, so you're going to have to get reassessed for another one. But if you get 275, that covers all 8. So if you've done multiple crimes, it's in your interest to get an assessment that gets you just high enough to count another... lashes. Full stop. Now let's just run through this Mishnah quickly, which describes the process. Kate said, Malkin Oto, how do you whip? Kofin shtei yadav al ha'amud helach ve'helach. There is a pole, much like this shtender, sat in the middle of the floor. I'm about to be lashed. My hands are tied to both sides of this pole as I am standing there. V'chazan ha'kneset oches b'vagad dav. And this is the one time the chazan gets to have a lot of fun. So the chazan, meaning the appointee of the court, grabs, right, part of the punishment is the chazan you've been objecting to for the whole of your life gets to rip your clothes off. So the chazan comes and he grabs your shirt, in koronit krovim nifrum nifrum, and if it gets stripped, it gets ripped, and if it gets hurt, meaning part of this, we're not telling him to be delicate with your clothing, we're not saying you have to rip it, but just be indifferent or to the situation. Archi megalet libo, until your chest is exposed. So again, if we just read this in the abstract, that's one thing. But if you're trying to imagine this, this is a kind of terrifying prospect. Your hands are bound. Somebody is ripping at your clothes, not intentionally to rip them, because that would be giving you too much attention. Just indifferently. And if they rip, they rip. If not, I don't care. I'm not treating you as a human being in this moment. I'm just, you are tied to a post and I'm ripping off your clothes, however they come. And it wasn't set up in advance. They would then put the podium behind you. And you know, as that stone was set down, someone will be standing on that in a minute and hitting me. This is a terrifying process. Chazan HaKneset, Omer L'Lav, and here the Chazan gets up, and you're like, just not Eitz Chaim, please, just not Eitz Chaim, not Brich Shemei. What's the Chazan going to do? So the Chazan gets up, Ritzu B'Yad Shel Egel, and he's holding this whip in his hand, and as you can see from the image, it is calf leather. Kfula echad l'shnayim l'shnayim l'arbayim. It's folded twice, so there are 8 folds, or however many folds you can see in it. Ushtei ritzuot shel chamor elos v'yardisbon. It's got 2 straps of donkey hide along either side. Again, why is it calf? Why is it donkey skin? What is the logic here? We'll talk about that another time. Yada tefach. The handle is a tefach long. V'rachva tefach, and the width of the whip is a tefach wide. So this is a thick, heavy, long strap. V'rosha magat al pikre so. And the head of it, if you whip somebody round the front, would then go round the back and come round to the stomach. So this is not like a small whip, like a little stick lash or something. This is a whip that extends, goes round, and in theory would wrap around the body. Where are we? Umaka, first one. Umaka to shlish melafan of ashtei yadot melacharav. And you get a third in the front on the chest, 2/3 on the back. And you're not sitting and you're not standing. So this is an uncomfortable position. You're standing tied to a post. You are bent over. The Apilo Ashovet, because the Pasuk says the judge will make you bent or make you fall. So you are now, they put the stone behind you. The Chazan gets up. You can hear the whip
oscillating in his hand because of the multiple folds. You know you're going to get hit by this. Vamaka melka beyado achat b'chol kocho. The court whipper cannot hold it with two hands. You have to use one hand, and it shouldn't be like a tap. B'chol kocho, you should, and again, you have to measure being the whipper. This is not easy. You have to use your whole strength to do this. Vahakore kore, and not only do you have a doctor on hand in addition to the chazan, you have somebody whose job is to read out these verses. And I gave you the sheet on the side. And the reason I did is because it's only got excerpts here in the Mishnah. And we're not going to read it here because of time. But if you read them all, you'll see that this is cementing. What is this about? This is about recognizing that your prohibitions are not just between you and God. Your prohibitions will wreak havoc in society. You need to live well in order to thrive. That third pasuk. Live faithfully in all the terms of this covenant that you can succeed. We want you, this is not God just arbitrarily hurting you. We need to do well. So Hakara cover these psukim. And then you go back and start again. If you are getting 85 lashes and you read the psukim and then it goes quiet, so go again, is the assumption. The chazan has to, these psukim have to be read all the way through. So you can imagine. And what's the last pasuk, by the way? Which, according to some Rishonim, is why we say that at the beginning of Maariv. Because Malkus used to be dispensed between Mincha and Maariv. So if you think it's painful to listen to a rabbi giving a Dvar Torah between Mincha and Maariv, imagine that you're getting lashes then instead, and that should make it more bearable. And that's why you say Vahur Achum at that point. And you can imagine now, for the rest of time, this guy, every Maariv, is going to be Vahur Achum, you know, starting traumatized by what this means, which for those Rishonim is what we should be thinking. Every time we say Vahur Achum before Maariv, we should mentally be lashing ourselves, not in kind of aggressive, self-harming terms, but we should be reviewing our behavior, reminding ourselves that punishment is about mercy in the best sense. When you go back to the beginning, last three lines, v'metachet yado pater. If you do happen to die as a consequence of this, the shlich based in the whipper is exempt. Meaning you had a doctor's assessment and this is not intentional. V'hosif lo odritzu achad umet. And if he added one extra though, meaning if you were, you could get 18 and he gave you 19 by mistake, harzeh gol al yado, you're off to galus, my friend. I know you didn't do this intentionally, but this is negligent. And it was, and we said in the second perek, if you're doing a mitzvah, even if it is shogeg, if you're doing a mitzvah, you're exempt from galus, like a parent or a teacher or the sheikh beisdin. And here if the sheikh beisdin adds one, it's not a mitzvah. So at that point, you go to galus and it's kalkal. And this is the key line, which is kind of, you know, sometimes they call bury the lead. This is burying the lead here. It's kalkal. If a person soils themselves, at any point in this process, you are exempt from lashes. Ben berei, ben b'mayim pater. Whether it is soiling yourself with excrement or soiling yourself with urine, any form of self-inflicted shame exempts you from this punishment. Which again tells you, what is the point of this punishment? It is about internal reaction. It is not about causing bruises on your back. It is about eliciting a sense of deep shame to recognize that what you've done is problematic. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda adds, ha'ish berei v'ha'isha b'mayim. Said, well, actually, if you're a man and you soil yourself with urine, you're not exempt, because apparently that's not shame enough, but it has to be. But if it's a woman, urine is enough, which reminds you, in the last two words, we're not just talking about men in this process. So that's the end of the Mishnah. We'll pick up next week with Chaf Gimel, which will be the last full daf, and then we'll head into the last page as we start landing the plane on this journey. So I thank you for your attention, and I wish you all a wonderful week.